Okay, so today's talk is given by David Mitchell, Director of Conservation with Historic Scotland, and his talk is entitled Digital Documentation of the Historic Environment and the Scottish Ten, as well as the exciting Scottish Ten project, which is the subject of various blogs and YouTube broadcasts, and which has recently taken him to Gujarat in northwest India. David has a background in conservation of cast iron structures, and prior to working for Historic Scotland, was a director of heritage engineering in Glasgow, where he spent 10 years working on the restoration and conservation of cast iron structures, both in the UK and abroad. And David is also a founding trustee of the Scottish Ironwork Foundation, a not-for-profit organisation which seeks to encourage the study of architectural and ornamental ironwork made or found in Scotland. He also has a background in earth sciences, he tells me, and is flying off to the Americas tomorrow to talk further about the Scottish Ten. So we're very fortunate to have him today to talk to us. David.
Thank you. The University of Edinburgh needs to invest in an HD projector, I think. Never mind, we'll try. This is very visual, so I hope this is not too boring. Just a wee bit first for the people that don't know anything about Historic Scotland, who we are. We're an agency of Scottish Government, which is a bit like having one foot in and one foot out. Fairly sizeable organisation. What we do splits into three parts, really. We've got a regulation side, which deals with development in the built environment, dealing with consents to listed buildings and scheduled ancient monuments. We've got a visitor services side of the house, which does the Edinburgh Castle bit and the visitor stuff, education of the school kids, interpretation, that side. And this bit on the left is my bit. And I, for my sins, look after 350 sites across Scotland from Munster and Shetland down to the borders. And I've got 350 staff who help me do that, or they do it actually. So I've also got responsibility for some of the other things you see here, so technical and scientific research, climate change, fly conservation, technical education, etc. And then amongst all that stuff, I've got responsibility for survey of our estate. So what I'm going to talk to you about today is something that I've kind of gotten really excited about over the past few years, and that's digital documentation of the historic environment. So what you see here is a bit of a first for Scottish Government, and that we've gone into business with Glasgow School of Art's Digital Design Studio, and we've had a research relationship with them for about over 5 years now, and my partner in crime there, Doug Pritchard, who's head of visualisation, and I worked together for 4 years now, through some of the projects that we did to develop some of the techniques we use. And last year we decided that we were going to do something with it, and we've created this limited liability partnership with the Art School to deliver the Scottish Ten project, to deliver a project at Bannockburn and Stirling, and also to undertake commercial projects as well as the Chase research and development funding. So that's really just kicked off in the past 3 months. And just by way of example, I'll just shut this up because it's tiny. This is a laser scan of the Guardian seal that William Wallace had for the brief period that he was Guardian of Scotland. So we're mostly talking about big stuff today, but the technology also goes for fairly small objects, as you'll see here. So, I'm sure lots of you know about laser scanning, but I assume you don't. Essentially, we are using primarily laser scanning techniques and some other digital data capture techniques, and the bulk of our work is done by terrestrial scanners. This is Alan on Orkney this summer with a Leica laser scanner. The laser scanner was invented by a man called Ben Kisira in the US. He's an amazing chap. He's become a good friend of mine. And an Iraqi-born American engineer stole the laser technology from the Star Wars program. Well, he didn't steal it, he borrowed it. And developed a laser scanner for scanning petroleum plants and oil refineries and the like. Ben was really interested in heritage and thought there was an application for documentation of sites When the Taliban blew up the Bamiyan Buddhas in Afghanistan, he kind of galvanized himself into action. He made a great deal of money selling his firm to Leica Geosystems and ploughed about $10 million into creating SIARC, which is a non-profit US body that charges around the world laser scanning historic sites and archiving them for the future. So, that technology came from Ben, and essentially, very simply how it works, you fire a laser from the scanner, hits the surface of an object, comes back, is triangulated. Because we know the speed of light, we get a very accurate measurement. So different types of laser scanner. Terrestrial scanner will give us with a straight survey of, it'll give us about 3 or 4 mil. Handheld scanner will get down to about 0.1 of a millimetre. This is something new we're playing about with, which is a mobile scanner, and we can drive at 60 miles an hour and scan with this, if you could drive through Edinburgh at 60 miles an hour. And you see, this is us coming down the Royal Mile, and it's capturing as we go. Now, the quality of that data isn't as good, but what you certainly can do, what we quite often do is go back and scan to build up. So the only other thing I haven't shown here is airborne LiDAR, which we also use as well. So we've got these different kind of meshes of data that we fit together for various purposes. The other thing that we are also very interested in, this is my thing, is HDR photography, which is a kind of stock technique now, actually. Our building survey guys use it, because how it works, basically, is you have the camera that will take an average exposure. This is a camera on automatic, and this is me setting the camera to take stops either side of the camera's computer, the way it's thinking, and it blends the exposures together. And it gives you this kind of surreal effect. It looks a bit eeky if you can overdo it photography-wise. But what actually is really good to do is pick out detail. The lighting it gives you is much more akin to what you actually see with the naked eye. If you've never read about HDR photography, you should have a look. You can even buy an iPhone after it now. You buy an iPhone after everything. The other thing that we do is quite a lot of infrared thermography, which relates to our energy efficiency and climate change work that we do. And we started to wrap that onto the point cloud, which is what we generate from the laser scan. So this is Roslyn Chapel, and this is us playing about and looking at heat loss, etc. in the building. Well, actually, we use this quite a lot on our sites, and my architect used this for chasing leaks, which is not very exciting, but we get big cold spots in the masonry where we've got leaks through buildings, and castles tend to leak a lot, so this is a technique that we're using more and more. One of the problems with infrared thermography is that the resolution isn't very good, but it's like all these technologies, is getting better very, very quickly. So, just to give you an idea, this is a part of a project that we did with the Art School in Glasgow, and this is us laser scanning from the street. And you'll see the circle, the kind of black spots is where we put the laser scanner. The wispy bits in the street are people, because they move about, unfortunately, which is quite cool. Everybody thinks this is like the Matrix, and we kind of call it that because it sounds cool. So you go from the point cloud, which is basically a dialed down version of your survey points, into a block model. Now, this kind of architectural modelling isn't new. You see it in Grand Design, you see it on the telly quite a lot. Where the synergy with us and the Art School is they're amongst the best architectural modellers I've ever seen. Some of the stuff they do is just frighteningly good. And there's a wonderful synergy that's developed there, because we're really interested in the objective recording, whereas they like the aesthetic. But what's really interesting about the modelling is it's got this accuracy built underneath it, which is tremendously useful. And from that from the laser scan data, we can take all sorts of stuff out. We can use it for lifting straight CAD drawings off. But our architectural technicians are starting to use the cloud now. And once you get used to working with it and manipulating with it, it's really useful, and you can get all sorts of things. And this is our scan team, who get really bored in a can-do room and decided to scan themselves. People always ask if there's a health and safety issue with the laser scanner. We've had a couple of drunks in Glasgow peering down the, the into the machine, but no, it's a safe way. And this is particularly, this is one of the early things that we did. This is the Duplin Cross in St. Serfs in Dunning. Now, this is a hand scan, so very accurate, and this is mesh data. This is raw data, but you're seeing a dialed-down version of it, which the computer can't handle. And if you see, when we rotated through that column there, one of the things that I love about laser scan data is it's light moving through, and it's often people think it's like an X-ray, which of course it isn't, because we're dealing with the surface. But it allows you to start to look at buildings in an entirely different way. So some of the early projects we did together, I've got a bit of an iron fetish, so there's quite a lot of iron projects in here. And we were testing out the practical applications of this stuff. And I have a couple of very good paint conservators in-house who could come in somewhere like this and tell you what the historic paint schemes were by taking samples off and analysing them, etc. So what we did, this is a fountain in Paisley that is in a hellish state, and the council wanted to know what the original colour scheme was. So we toddled off and did some archive research and discovered it was done by a chap called Daniel Cottier, who eventually went off and worked with Tiffany in the US, a kind of unknown Scot who did very well for himself. So it takes on a historic importance, and what we did here was match from the laser scan data the original colour scheme of the fountain. So what you see there is that modelled very, very accurately, to the extent that I thought that was too glossy the first time I saw it, and my paint guys were going, no, it had four layers of shellac on it, that's the lustre. And we would never have got that, but the guys colouring up a drawing like we would have done even 3 or 4 years ago. So applications of this technology, the art school, when we started to work with them, we were in the midst of doing a project to document Big Chunk in the centre of Glasgow, which was really interesting. And that was mostly about creating an urban model for Glasgow. So the area that we've scanned, you see contained here, mostly along Clydeside and up into bits of town, university, etc. What's interesting about this, we met them this week with the British Geological Survey to talk about doing above and below ground. BGS have done some similar stuff in terms of below ground geology and looking at seafloor movement and that type of stuff. And they've actually got really good data, and we've been kind of showing each other this stuff, and they've been flying us below the ground and we've been above. So it's a no-brainer, we stick them together, which has been really interesting. So, again, create this model, let's go for that. And what we do, this kind of just gives you an idea of the process we go through. We create a block model, and then we model it to produce a hyper-real image. It's really nice because we can make it sunny, we can take litter off the streets, etc. And there's only one statue in the Glasgow model, and that's Wellington, because we thought it was such an icon that we had to do Wellington with his traffic cone, and it's become a bit of a symbol for our centre. And I do this talk to Americans who don't get the humour. One of the other things that we've immediately jumped on this technology-wise for is in terms of planning. We've got a fantastic facility in Glasgow, which is a bit like a big squash court, and we're at the stage we can almost project to create an immersive environment, and we can stand planning committee on the street and drop a building in and look at the building from different viewpoints, and we get round the architect's drawing with the kids with the balloons and the strategically placed tree over the duff detail in the building, which the planners really like, the architects don't. But certainly that's a really interesting development, and something that we're about to do in Edinburgh as well. We're about to document a World Heritage site. So it also provided a really interesting snapshot of Glasgow at that point at the start of the 21st century. For the most part, we haven't included street furniture, although there's some bits here, and we kept it fairly clean. Oops, killed that. Come on, go back. So, beyond that, in terms of the application of this stuff, there's a straight survey thing for us. I've got 345 sites to look after, documentation for these sites is pretty poor, to be honest with you. And it would take about 100 years to do traditional survey to the level that we would require. We're about to embark on a survey programme that will take about 10 years that will give us about 4 mil accuracy in all our structures across the estate. When we started to go with this, we were looking at what other people were doing in terms of immersive, lots of military training type stuff being done in the US. And one of the things that we're looking at for Bannockburn and the representation of the Bannockburn Heritage Centre is an immersive medieval battle experience. So we drop you into the middle of this medieval battle, take you back to 1314, which is quite exciting, but is again pushing in a different, slightly different type of application. And then we do completely reconstructive stuff like this. This is John Brown Shipyard in Clydebank. And this was done as for a history project at Tyne Crane in Glasgow, but we've also used this to show school kids in Clydebank what it used to look like. Again, it's a bit too pristine for reality, but this kind of stuff is actually really quick and easy for us and is a really way of engaging with kids that they understand. Kids generally don't get impressed with this stuff either. So I'm going to show you some of the projects that we've been involved with recently. This is an interesting one. Historic Scotland put quite a lot of money into Rutland Chapel. It's still ongoing just now. As many of you know, Roslyn became very famous overnight when Mr. Brown wrote his book. So this tiny little heritage trust all of a sudden had to deal with exponential visitor growth. And then the film came out and it just went nuts. So we've been talking to him quite a long time. The visitor pressure in the building was phenomenal. It's tailing off a wee bit now, but it was quite scary. And there was actually damage being done to the fabric of the building. Historic Scotland's predecessors, we found out in the 1920s, did something terrible to the inside of the building. It has a masonry roof. They've used a really porous sandstone and the water absolutely pisses through the building and has caused all sorts of problems to the carved detailing and to the interior. So my predecessor decided it would be a good idea to paint the inside of it with a cementitious slurry. And all that's done really is kept the water and stone and decayed the building. So hence the agricultural roof over here. That's been up for a long time now. Well, it's just come off. But the logic behind that was to allow the building to dry out. But the Trust were really keen for us at that stage to give them some advice on the building. They were really worried about the roof and how thick it was and all sorts of things. And at this point, we hadn't really done a big building. So we said we would do Roslyn. Now, Roslyn had been laser scanned quite late 90s, but with the technology quite early on. It was a good survey, actually, but... we decided to have another go. So we did it in 2.5 days, collected billions of points. And what was really interesting, you see the degree of ornamental detail, and I was fairly circumspect about our ability to capture that without lots of holes in the data because it is a line of sight thing. So this is us up on the roof. I was quite shocked when I saw this picture of an 80 grand scanner perched up on the roof of the building, never mind. So we scan the site, and then, as usual, we pick out the context of the site as well, which is fairly interesting. You can see we've removed the canopy over the church as well, and we produce these, which are slices through the data. And it's one of the great things about point cloud information—you can start to slice through the data. These images ended up in Time magazine this summer. Had us say, God, they had this horrible quote and said that we'd found a holy grail under here and we were looking for this and that. You know, but you can see it starts to present the building in a different way. We struggled a wee bit with the modellers because the modellers kind of looked at this stuff and said, well, we've got holes in the data, we'll just fill them in. And we said, no, that's subjective. We either leave them black where we don't have data or we mark it as blue and then, you know, that's areas where we don't have data and we can go back to in the future. And then we do things like this, slice through the building, which is quite cool. So this is kind of it for me. I really like the high definition, very architectural modelling, but in terms of purely objective modelling, this is pure data, and it just gives us tremendous detail. What we've also started to do is wrap a prototype from the data. So I've got a nice selection of things in my office that we've produced from the point cloud information. And really interesting stuff we've been doing with Catherine Forsyth of Glasgow Uni, who's the Pictish Ogham expert, which is an ancient Scots language, or a Pictish language, as you'd say. And actually, with manipulating the data, Catherine is able to read things off the inscriptions at Dunad, where the Scots kings were crowned, stuff in the back of the Dublin Cross that's given her new information on Scotland in the 8th century, which is fascinating. So again, you see here we've got holes in the data, and that's fine. We actually went back and re-scanned some of this stuff. The terrestrial scanners like to be quite stable. They don't really like moving about much, or that's the considered normal. I'm going to show you some stuff later that maybe contradicts that a wee bit. The portable scanner is really interesting because it trails a thing at the back of the car and tracks where it is GPS, so it knows where it is, which is really clever. There's a fantastically clever piece of software in there that manages that. And then, this is the biggest building we've done to date. We're going to do all of our sites, and we had to develop a methodology. So we decided to do Stirling. And we've used a variety of techniques. We've flown Stirling from the Wallace Monument across to the castle and across the Bannockburn, because we were very conscious that if we were going to do some immersive reality experience, the part of the Wars of Independence story was based around these areas. And we wanted to set it in context. So here's a hand scanner. This one's £500,000, which I can't convince my finance director for us to buy. So this one we beg, borrow, and rent occasionally. Terrestrial scanner. Again, this is James V. And what's interesting, this is the Palace project. We're doing a major refurb just now. And a lot of this detail is not seen by the visitors. They just don't pick it up because it's too high up. And one of the things that has been interesting for us is bringing that stuff down virtually and making it accessible. So, this is where there's 2 billion points, we're up to about 12 billion points, measured points on the castle now. So, this is a hand scan, this is the stuff you saw the chap doing earlier. So, this is basically running up a piece of carved detail up to James V. And it's really interesting because we've rapid prototyped them. So kids can pick it up and handle it, and it doesn't matter if they drop it, and they can get very tactile with it in a way that we don't tend to let them do with the monuments themselves. This is some of the education stuff we're working on just now, so this is just a snapshot of some modelling. This building was highly decorated. If any of you have been to Stirling, you'll know the Great Hall is a kind of an off-white colour, and there's bits of gilding at the top level. The palace was pink. Bright pink, with vermilion red window bars. It had gold and silver everywhere. Our archaeologists call it medieval bling, but that's really what it was. It was about saying, this is a royal palace, and look at how wealthy and important we are. So we're going to do it virtually with the palace. We did it in reality with the Great Hall, and it caused such a hoo-ha, because it was quite a visual impact thing. The other interesting thing you get from laser scan is you get a very accurate measurement, and you also get a reflectance variation depending on the surface of the material. So what you can see here, and a lot of the stuff you can see with the naked eye, you can see the different types of masonry reflecting differently to the laser, and we can actually see where masonry has been robbed from another building on the site and been reused here. And you obviously can see the window openings that have been closed up. And we also can see fissures and things that sometimes you don't pick up with the naked eye. So this is a laser scan of a passageway that runs underneath the palace. And I talked to you earlier about looking at a building a different way. The archaeologists get really excited with this because they've never seen this roof from above. before. And of course, they're not really seeing it from above. They're seeing the data from underneath and from up above. But they got excited nevertheless. But it is interesting in terms of being able to deconstruct a building like that. And then we move on to the... For this one, one of the outputs is going to be an iPad app. And we're doing a bit of work with Apple to do an augmented reality app, which we're both quite excited about. And the idea is that you'll walk around the site and you'll trigger... So James V will come out of the building and talk to you, and you'll stand there and look at him and look at the building at the same time. Which is quite exciting. And the other kind of thing, I don't know if you, this was on BBC Two a couple of months ago, called Cold Case, and this was a knight that we dug up. His head was in about 12 pieces, and one of my guys scanned the pieces and virtually reconstructed them. And it was interesting, they thought he'd been killed by this blow to the head, and actually when we virtually reconstructed him, that was an old wound, and he'd actually been killed with a pike shot through his face, which is this symbol here, which is nice. but you can imagine how cool the kids would love this. So that's another application that we've messed about with. This has taken us a bizarre route, and that we've done some work for the police on crime scene investigation. And the US have done quite a bit of this. In terms of recording crime scenes. And we helped Central Scotland Police recently look at quite a horrible road accident. There was a real whodunit, there was a pedestrian got killed, and they couldn't understand, so we helped them with that, scanning the crime scene, and they were able to work out what happened as a result, which is quite interesting. So, I'm going to tell you a little bit about the Scottish 10 project and just show you some examples. Quite an exciting project for us to do, and it's been really good to get people thinking of Historic Scotland as not the old fusty organisation that perhaps people we thought of was. Got a really nice website too, which is scottish10.org, and it kind of follows us as we travel around the world and can access all sorts of video clips and footage, etc. So, what is it? Ben Casino was a tuning the ear of Mike Russell, who was our minister at the time, for Scotland to participate in the SIARC project to document heritage sites in Scotland. And Mike got really enthusiastic about the idea of the project, but also about the idea of us doing something that was quite innovative and wanted to show Scotland could still do this stuff. So he agreed with Ben that we would do the five World Heritage Sites in Scotland, which is fine, and I think that's great. And then he says, well, tell you what, for everyone we'll do in Scotland, we'll do one overseas too. And sometimes politicians do that to us, and they'll say, yes, we want you to go and move that mountain over there. And Mr. Russell is certainly one of them. But fantastic, he really pushed us. And he said to us, right, okay, I want you to learn from this, I want you to get lots of good PR for Scotland, obviously. But there was all sorts of other stuff built into it, which is really exciting. So, these are the Scottish sites. I'll show you some of the stuff we've done. We've done bits and pieces of these. We haven't got near St Kilda yet, and that's a logistical nightmare. We've done Mount Rushmore. Shows you here, says Doug, trying to look as if he's not terrified. As mentioned earlier, we've just come back from India. We're going to do a site in Japan and China, which are other international objective countries of the Scottish Government. And then we've got one up our sleeve, which the Boffins are trying to keep. We want to keep one to do something really funky, but we haven't thought what. We've been doing some experimentation with underwater laser scanning, and we're quite interested in maybe doing something with Scapa Flow. So, why? I usually get asked why we're spending £1 million of taxpayers' money doing this. And I've been asked a part of that question. But it really has, it's paid for itself already. We've done one international site, which is Mount Rushmore, and we've calculated the media value alone of that for Scotland was worth £3.5 million against £40,000 to do Mount Rushmore. We had every major newspaper in the US, right across television. It's fantastic. Huge, huge profile. There is also a bit about us learning and pushing. Rushmore was picked because of the profile thing and the icon thing. It was going to be that or the Statue of Liberty. But it actually did technologically pushes a bit, because we discovered quite quickly we were going to have to get the scanner over the front of the monument to pick up the detail in the faces, which had a lot of head scratching. This is Orkney. We're still working on the data for Orkney, and it was quite handy because Orkney is one of our sites. A real mix of, so this is inside the house 7 at Scarabray. And you'll see the timber on the roof. We don't let people into the houses at Scarabray anymore. One time used to be like going and clamber them all over them, but they're too sensitive now, so we actually, people don't get in here. So that's interesting in itself. This is the entranceway to the burial tomb at Mace Howe. Now, obviously, we're operating this as a visitor attraction, so the guys have to spend the night in the tomb. Apparently, the Norse legend is if you spend the night in the tomb, you go crazy. The guys were having pizza delivered from Kirkwall, which they thought was really, really amusing. But picked up all, there's all sorts of, if you've never been here, go to Orkney and see. There's all sorts of Viking runic inscriptions on the interior of the tomb, which are starting to fade now. But actually, great for interpretation. Kids love it as well because it's all really naughty Viking runes about the easy virtues of the Orkney women. I'm sure that's still the case. So, this is the guy who's doing this overnight. It's pretty cold, I think. This is Ring of Brodgar, and this is a kind of general snapshot of the village at Scarabray. When we were up there, there was a dig being done at Ness of Brodgar by Orkney College. And they kind of pleaded with us to spend an afternoon. They'd exposed this amazing. It looks like it might be one of the most important excavation discoveries in Europe in the past 5 to 10 years. It's a phenomenal building. And they were about to backfill it again for the season, so we went in and laser scanned it in an afternoon for them, which they were really excited about. New Lanark was the first World Heritage site we did in Scotland. Because it's quite compact, the challenge that we've had at New Lanark is meshing the, sort of joining the data that we've generated here into the context of the site and the LIDAR, because it's based at the bottom of quite a steep river valley. This one we're going to take with the New Lanark Trust, and we're going to develop an evolution of the site. So we'll start with the Greenfield site. And why did Owen and Dale want to come to New Lanark? What was it about New Lanark? So we can show the river, the offtake of the river. And what we can do is follow the power trail. So you come down the mill lane here, go in here into the water wheel that used to sit underneath the buildings. And there are actually big wheel pits underneath these buildings, nobody get near. So we can reconstruct that stuff virtually, so kids get a sense. Otherwise, it's just a collection of pretty buildings for them. So that kind of reconstruction is very helpful from an education point of view. And this is Mount Rushmore, South Dakota. Quite a bonkers place. It's in the middle of nowhere. And that's kind of the point. It was done during the Depression to keep local miners in work. And this crazy sculptor called Borlum decided that he would carve this memorial into the sacred of Black Hills of Dakota, which kind of upset the locals quite rightly. And they've actually responded by building a massive, taking a mountain and creating a massive sculpture of Geronimo about 10 miles away, which is 10 times the size. It's going to take, it's funny, I was there recently and the guy said it was going to take them another 200 years, they reckon. So you see here, it's quite challenging. The National Park Service were really interested. They were, I have to be careful, we don't have any Americans here, do we? Yes, right. conservation-wise, the US are about 50 years behind us. And I was appalled when we went to site, and obviously there's lots of granite in Scotland. I've got a granite expert in-house who deals with nothing but granite buildings. And we had a look at the site, and they were telling us they were really worried about movement in the, they were worried that some engineers thought that Washington was sliding down the hill, etc. And they were getting this huge movement. And what it actually was the thermal movement of the thing heating up during the day and contracting at night. So really basic stuff that we're struggling with. And it did some horrible things to the some of the fissures and cracks in the granite. It's a really coarse granite, quite unlike the stuff that we have here. But they'd gone around filling all the stuff with mastic because they were worried about water penetration and frost heave and that kind of stuff, and got slightly hysterical about it. What actually became apparent when they were out there, why they really wanted us to scan it, is that they had known terrorist activity within the park. Now, if you're going to take something out, the Statue of Liberty or Rushmore as an icon of the US, and the Secret Service were very worried about what could happen at Rushmore. It's now like Fort Knox, and we were the last people to get up on the mountain. At one point, you could, if you knew the Rangers, get up onto the heads, but we were pretty much the last people to do that. Initially, the 2 days after our initial scoping visit, if you remember, but Greenpeace climbers got up and dropped a huge banner down here, and it created a huge fuss. But a fantastically interesting site. This is it in evolution. The Native Americans still see it as desecration, but actually the superintendent who was there when we did this project was a Native American who had been put in there to try and calm some of that stuff down. A really, really cool guy. So you see the evolution of the site. All done with hydraulic, mostly done with dynamite, and then the faces finished off with hydraulic tools. Nobody killed at all during the project. It was supposed to keep on going, but they ran out of money, and basically Congress stopped it by not giving them any more money. But you were supposed to be down to about waist height. So, sometimes one of the perks of my jobs, apart from the dull stuff dealing with budgets in HR, stuff. I get to cool places sometimes, and standing on George Washington's head was definitely one of the cool parts of my job. I've got a bit of a reputation in the Scottish Tenant for being a bit of a jinx. I managed, as we were coming down off the head, to fall about 15 feet and land on my head, fractured my skull and broke ribs and did all sorts of horrible things to myself. Ended up in hospital, which was nice. So that was quite fun because it wasn't fun at all. After the Park Service got over the shock of killing somebody from a foreign government, once they realised it was okay, they completely overhauled their health and safety regime. And Americans are shockingly bad at health and safety. They're such a litigious society. It's shockingly bad. So no helmets or anything on. So when my guys went back in the summer, they were really, really kitted up, roped up, etc. When I was there, I got to go and sit on the edge and dangle my feet over. It was quite fun filling that form out for health and safety as well. So, when it came to doing the project, the guys went out in May this year, early May. South Dakota's got an odd climate, and at that point, the Park Service had said, it's a good time to come, potentially you'll get good clear weather, but it can be a bit odd out here at that point. So this is the guys planning the scan positions to ensure they get maximum coverage of the faces. This is the guys trying to look as if they were... So essentially, you've got a mix of my guys from Historic Scotland, people from the Art School, and we've got some people from SIARC there as well from California. These are guys from the National Park Service. And it's fantastic. They really bonded as a team. And you guys will know this yourselves, when you get with people who are passionate about the same things you are, it kind of really breaks down barriers, and we've seen that recently in India as well. So they were fantastically helpful. These guys are really good at rope access. When we went up, you actually have to walk and climb up here, and there's a secret canyon up here you go around to get up onto the heads. We did not want to carry our stuff up there, so they put a rope line in for us to shuttle our stuff up. Wouldn't put people on it, unfortunately, but our kit all went up there. And then I mentioned about a scanning on the face of the presidents. And Ben Kazira, who invented the laser scanner, said, look, I don't think there's any reason why we can't drop a laser scanner over the front here and suspend it. So we made up this little tripod bracket. The US Air Force made it for us. There's a big Air Force base nearby. And we did some trials at low ground, and Doug here was very worried that it wasn't going to work. There was going to be vibration and movement. And it worked perfectly. It was fantastic. We got the shock absorption just right. And as long as it was very still, the data was absolutely fine. So the Americans call this stuff Talus. It's like big scree, I suppose. But so we scanned everything. This was all stuff that had been dynamited off the face originally. And this is where I fell off, actually. So you see Lynn standing here with a helmet on, because our boss was stupid. And then this is us up in the head with a 80 grand laser scanner. And our laser scanner, actually, not the Glasgow School of Arts laser scanner, which I always point out to them, and it's about to go over the edge. And then this happened. The guys appeared one morning, and it dumped about a foot of snow, which was a nightmare. And that lasted for about 2 days. And then it completely disappeared. It was beautiful sunshine for a day, and then it dumped another foot of snow the next day. So they had a really tough first week trying to get things to happen. But eventually, did clear up, and the guys were able to get up. And the view's just fantastic. You've been here before, but this is basically a big multi-story car park, which is not very attractive. You come up this very patriotic avenue of flags, which is flags from all the states. And then there's this amphitheatre here, and at night they have a light show, which sounds really cheesy, but it's actually quite good. And they can have 20,000 people there of a Sunday evening watching a light show. So we're still processing the data. We don't have any animations of that of the data yet, but this we are really, really chuffed with the quality of the data that's coming out. It's just phenomenal. And I think the Park Service are actually quite surprised at what we've done. I don't think they expect it to be this good. So they want us to do some stuff with kids that allows them to manoeuvre themselves up close to the faces and look into the eyes and all that kind of stuff. And there's really interesting things. You know, there's a chisel stuck in Washington's pupil in his eye, and it's great to be able to show that to kids and show them the finishes on the rock. This is incredibly hot and sweaty. This is Rani Kibab in Gujarat, Northwest India. This is Chris, my deputy, and I out scoping this project. And the Archaeological Survey in India gave us three sites in the northwest to scan. And we saw this one on the first day and just said, oh, this is it. This is absolutely phenomenal. It's part of a water complex. This is the well part of the complex, which is phenomenal. About 1,000 AD. Hundreds and hundreds of really detailed pieces of carved stone everywhere. This is the well part. And depending on where the water level is, there are different bits of carving to suit, so nothing's ever naked really. Absolutely beautiful. But when you walk into the site, all you can see is grass, and then you just come up to the edge as you see here, and it just drops down. It was silted up until about the 1960s, when ASI then desilted it and took the material out. It's phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal. And the stone is incredibly crisp. The detail is bonkers. It's a complete nightmare for us to document. We could be here for 5 years with a hand scanner, just picking up all this detail, so we know we could do it. We've got to do something within about 3 weeks. So what we're probably going to do is a mixture of laser scanning, some kind of photogrammetry. We really have to kind of work it out. We've got a bit of a brainstorm in a couple of weeks about how we're going to approach this. But one of the key things for us is we're going to bring a couple of the survey guys from ASI across to Scotland in January, poor souls, and they're going to work with us to learn about the technology and its application. So we just don't dip in and out. ASI are thinking about buying a laser scanner, and we'll help to train them up to use it. So we're planning to do this probably in April next year, and First Minister was out and announced this with the Indian Prime Minister last month. So again, a big international coverage. Okay, thanks.
thanks very much for a visually stunning talk. Very interesting. Questions from the floor?
Are you all wowed by the graphics?
It is Friday afternoon.
It's the dark night.
Okay, Nick.
What is the basic technique that you use to co-register the data that you get from the different scan sites? So you've got the scanner and you there, and then you can mesh your splicing together.
I hate when I get asked to take your questions because it's not me. It's all tied back to GPS, and what we do is that we have to overlap when we scan. So if you scan an elevation, we make sure there's sufficient overlap, and the software automatically matches it. It doesn't always work, something depending on what we're scanning, but if it's masonry.
So the GPS gives you the approximate location, and then you can just
match it. And what's really interesting with that is that if we say we were outside here and we had a GPS spot and you scan on the outside, if you come in and scan on the inside, as long as your data's tied on the inside and outside, you can follow the data through.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then we steal all sorts of different bits of software. And it's really interesting, people keep on describing what we're doing as being innovative. The innovative bit is actually the different technologies we're bringing together and the bits of software that we're stealing from, you know, so the some of the modelling stuff we're doing is some of the stuff the guys at Pixar do, and they'll actually look, okay, they've been looking at what we've been doing recently. So there's stuff that we'll steal there, and then the engineering type rapid prototyping stuff is a whole different thing that we'll steal wholesale as well.
Guy. You said you had some sort of tactile applications,
uh-huh,
and sort of where people really interact. What sort of applications do you use surveying now? What do you have already? What sort of haptic devices can you use to sort of interact with the masonry? Is it really accurate enough to be able to tell us the rock formations?
We haven't. Well, the rapid prototyping stuff we've done, and we've used that for generating patterns to remake cast iron components and the like. The stuff that we're doing just now for Bannockburn is all about the haptic stuff. So we want you, there's a sword at Stirling, it's William Wallace's sword, but the kind of logic goes that you can scan his sword and you can put the gloves on and be able to manipulate the thing. That's the kind of stuff we're playing about with just now. We've also done some stuff with our acoustics on 3D sound, they have a fantastic facility in Glasgow where we mess about with that stuff too. So it's that interaction with the data, and that's the challenge, and that's where all the R&D needs to be. But it's like, which way do you go first?
Yeah. This is very impressive stuff, but I was wondering whether at some point do you have in mind of printing that stuff? I mean, do you have the technology of replicating a model and probably so somebody someday can just touch it as well?
Oh, yes. Yeah, so we're doing that just now.
Not only seeing it, but uh-huh, touching it and feeling the model.
We've just done an interesting project where we've laser scanned masonry detail on a building, and it's going through a rapid prototyping machine in a stonemason's yard. And we are recreating stone corbels. They have to be hand finished, but it's given us tremendously accurate detail. We're talking to somebody about recreating Rodin's The Thinker. They want us to do a bit of animation and then recreate that. I'm going out to see National Geographic next week, who are extremely interested in us creating all sorts of things for an exhibition where people can come in and visually and physically touch things and feel things and shapes and that.
Comparing to the quality of the data when you visualize it and when you print it, what's the difference? I mean, for instance, when I make maps and I print them, they're a bit different.
Mm-hmm.
When you do the same, what happens?
It's not as accurate. I can't remember the actual that we've got a percentage loss. If we do it one for one, it's something like about 75% accurate, which is still pretty good. And the application I was talking about earlier, where we're looking at an inscription on a stone, and this is where you don't get the applications until somebody in the field says to you, Catherine says, well, do you know what, Dunad's lovely, but Argyll rains a lot, and I get fed up sitting on top of that field trying to read this inscription on my hands and knees. So we've replicated our one in Foam that she can have in her office, and she can sit with a cup of coffee and look at the inscription, and we can stretch the data, we can increase the inscription. And I've seen her doing it, she'll sit and run her fingers around the inscription to, you know, that's fantastic. But there is a loss, there certainly is a loss, but it's pretty accurate, and it's getting better. And the limitation isn't the data, it's the manufacturing. It's the manufacturing side.
All right, one from Eddie.
How well does this process work for actual platforms? I'm thinking about things like vegetation. I know it's been models of Roslyn Chapel and Lanark Head Trees. Are they real trees that are being based on this?
Yep. One of the things, National Geo asked us if we can scan a redwood, and they've been doing this project with gigapixel photography, where you merge hundreds of thousands of high quality images to create some infinitesimal detail. And they saw this stuff and said, can you scan a redwood? As long as it's not windy, you know, but yeah, that's easy. And certainly landscapes and stuff are really easy. I think there's lots of potential for geomorphology and certainly for us coastal erosion, and certainly at Scarabray, where the sea really wants to take Scarabray back. That kind of stuff's really interesting for us. Lots of application. But yeah, I'll pick up anything. I talked to a guy recently who had a terrible job. He had to scan Angelina Jolie in a skin tight satin suit. For Beowulf, she was in Beowulf, and that's quite a standard method of data capture. So when we do Bannockburn, we'll scan people and drop them in for that, and that's quite a standard technique in Hollywood for data capture.
Robin,
I
want to
talk about your policy for ruined castles and strongholds in Scotland. You don't allow people to reconstruct them. You went to the Czech Republic. The Department of Environment actually reconstructed a lot of the castles that were destroyed, say, during the last World War. Mm-hmm. And this allowed you to change your policy in the sense that you could actually visualise and reconstruct graphically what it was like, and then guide the building of them as well. So would you change your policy on that?
That's an interesting one. I wasn't expecting a question like that today.
Is that allowing you to tourists like to see finished castles, not ruined castles?
That's an interesting one, but there's a range of it. That's a whole hour in itself. But there are all sorts of conservation policies. There are things in Scotland that have been rebuilt, things that have been rebuilt without the proper information, which I think are wrong. There are buildings that Historic Scotland have rebuilt, like the Great Hall at Stirling Castle, but the evidence there was pretty good, so we knew what was there. But it was still a reconstruction. There's lots of castles in the northeast. We've got an initiative going on just now called the Castle Initiative, where we're actively identifying castles that we think could and potentially should be reconstructed. And there are other ones where they may have been derelict for 100 years or so, more than that, some of them, and there's no archaeological evidence to say what these look like. And then you get into this kind of circular argument, well, if you ask me as a buildings person, the best way to preserve a building is to put a roof on it, because it works and keeps the water out, does that stuff. But it's completely conjectural. So then other people would say, that's Disneyland, you can't do that. So it's a perpetual fine line.
Right, it's in Scotland, doesn't matter. All
right, I'll give you an example. Let's think of a Scottish icon. Car that Jackie Stewart won the world championship in. Okay, it's what was the boat that was pulled up from Lake Windermere? It's an even better example. The Bluebird. That's a good one. You take that up out of the water. It has huge cultural significance, and it tells the story of that object and of that man and of that time in terms of what it's like. If you then reconstruct it, you lose the value and the authenticity of that. If you do the same with a building, you could argue that you do the same. There are arguments for doing it. There are some museums that will do very patent, this is a new bit kind of stuff, and Historic Scotland do that, where we would replace a stone that decayed. So my guys will put it in and they'll put a date in the stone to say, so it's self-documenting. But we then have to decide, do we want to be a society that has kind of faux Scottish culture, or do we want to show something that's actually more tangible than that? And it's interesting because lots of research has shown that people want a genuine experience and want that authenticity. They don't want to see a pastiche. But it's something I'm really interested in, and sometimes we get it wrong. And the evolution of thought also, I mean, there's a couple of really high profile cases in Scotland that burble around backwards and forwards, and I always think it's interesting if you looked at them 50 years down the line, take a completely different view maybe.
I suppose you do technology gives you a chance to rethink.
Well, Scarabray is an interesting one. That we've got a young archaeologist doing a PhD just now looking at reconstructing Scarabray, because we won't let her play with the real thing, but she can do it virtually. Yeah, there is something there, definitely.
Angus? Can I ask what sort of limitations are of the technology in terms of just the sheer volume of data that all this...
Was it 12
million or
12
billion?
12 billion, yeah. Talk to our IT guys, they hate me.
Yeah, you sort of running these supercomputers in this...
Do you know what actually... they're high-spec machines with very nice graphic cards and all that kind of stuff, but they're not that, you know, a couple of grand's worth, which is not out of scope. Data storage is the big deal. And you may know that the Royal Commission is the National Archive repository for building data in Scotland. And just now, they're slightly panicked with this stuff because we want to give them 300 terabytes of data. But to be honest, data's just data. And its storage is just costs money. You've got to decide whether it's of value in the future. The big challenge for us is data migration.
Yeah.
And that's the one that's really tricky. The Library of Congress in the US will not accept laser scan data from Ben because it's not of archival quality. And he gets really mad. It's basically an X, Y, and a Z and a reflectance value. And he said the only archival medium that we'll accept is paper because we know that that will last 500 years. So he's threatened to print it out for them. Some bits of archives are like that. The Commission actually are very good and understand the potential value of this stuff, so they're working really hard to get themselves in a position where they can deal with the kind of data.
Does that mean the sort of immersive technology stuff you were saying about, you know, like, say, lots of military applications in some states and stuff like that, is that kind of, how far away is that in terms of being economically viable for tourist attractions and things like that, or is it
not? Well, it's
horrendously expensive if you could afford it in Scotland.
It's what we're doing at Bannockburn. And the logic is that Bannockburn has become a showpiece for that stuff. The problem is, as soon as we put it in 2014, within 5 years, we're going to be able to do something much better. And from an interpretation point of view, that's what my colleagues would say. You know, a signboard is a signboard that will last forever and a day. Yeah, it's not very high tech, but it does its purpose. So that is a challenge, but I mean, people quite often talk about the costs for this stuff. $80,000 for a laser scanner, it was $100,000 2 years ago. 10 years down the line, survey companies are going to have these as standard pieces of equipment.
Really, iPhone 5.
Well, exactly. or a 3D camera or the like. So that's less and less and less of an argument. I mean, you remember when digital cameras came out. And certainly nobody would think you would get a 48 megapixel digital camera, which you can now, and just frightening quality. So, you know, and even that's not that expensive anymore.
OK. Okay, I think it's heading towards pub time. But just to say thanks once again. Firstly, thank David just to shoot off, a busy man. It's interesting and visually stunning, as I say. Nice pictures and animations of fairly impressive places. I think I'll have to go and visit some of them. So, it's maybe, just to say that I think we're heading to the library bar after much debate between Bannerman's and the library bar in Teviot. I think Teviot has won out, so we will head there for more discussion or chat and relaxation, possibly some drinking.
Sure.
And that is about it. I think just to say thanks to Demetrius for setting up, and hopefully some of my able volunteers will fill the dishwasher. So if you just want to thank David once again. Say the final talk before Christmas is in 2 weeks' time, and we have Hugh Buchanan from the Boundaries Commission to be talking about boundaries and the political shenanigans that go with them. So thanks for coming. See you in 2 weeks.